I'd lost it amid the blowdowns and temporary roads that crisscrossed and eventually obliterated the trail. I wasn't terribly alarmed at first, believing that the road I was following would snake its way back to another place where it intersected the trail. But it didn't. I pulled out my map and compass and got my bearings, or what I believed were my bearings. My orienteering skills were still rather unreliable. I followed another road, but it only led to another and another, until I couldn't clearly recall which one I'd been on before. I stopped to eat lunch in the mid-afternoon heat, my monumental hunger slightly deadened by the queasy realization that I didn't know where I was. I silently lambasted myself for having been so careless, for pushing on in my annoyance rather than pausing to consider a course. But there was nothing I could do now. I took off my Bob Marley t-shirt and draped it over a branch to dry, pulled another t-shirt from my pack and put it on. Ever since Paco had given me the Bob Marley shirt, I'd carried two, switching them out during the day, the same way I did my socks. Though I knew such a practice was a luxury that only added more weight to my pack. I studied my map and walked on, down one rough logging road and then another, feeling a flutter of hope each time that I'd found my way back on track. But by early evening, the road I was on ended in a bulldozed heap of dirt, roots, and branches as high as a house. I scaled it for a better view and spotted another road across an old, clear-cut swath. I made my way across it until one of my sandals fell off, both the duct tape and the strap that held it across the top of my foot having detached from the rest of the shoe. "Oh!" I yelled and looked around, feeling the strange hush of the trees in the distance. They were like a presence, like a people, protectors who would get me out of this mess, though they did nothing other than silently look on. I sat in the dirt among the weeds and knee-high saplings and did more than extensive repair on my shoes. I constructed a pair of metal gray booties by winding the duct tape around and around my socks and the skeletal remains of my sandals, as if I were making a cast for my broken feet. I was careful to wind them tight enough that the booties would stay on while I hiked, but loose enough that I could pry them off at the end of the day without ruining them. They had to last me all the way to Castle Crags. And now I had no idea how far away that might be or how I would get there. In my duct tape booties, I continued across the clear cut to the road and looked around. I wasn't sure anymore in which direction I should go. The only views I had were those afforded me by the clear cuts and roads. The woods were a dense thicket of fir trees and fallen branches, and the day had taught me that the logging roads were only lines in an inexplicable maze. They'd go west and then northeast and later veer south for a stretch. To make matters more complicated, the section of the PCT between Burney Falls and Castle Crags didn't go north so much as in a wide westerly hook. It seemed unlikely that I could even pretend to be following the trail's course anymore. My only goal now was to find my way out of wherever I was. I knew if I went north, I'd eventually run into Highway 89. I walked the road until it was nearly dark and found a reasonably flat stretch beside it in the woods to pitch my tent. I was lost, but I was not afraid, I told myself as I made my dinner. I had plenty of food and water. Everything I needed to survive for a week or more was in my backpack. If I kept walking, I'd find civilization eventually. And yet, when I crawled into my tent, I shivered with palpable gratitude for the familiar shelter of the green nylon and mesh walls that had become my home. I squiggled my feet carefully out of my duct tape booties and set them in the corner. I scanned the maps in my guidebook for the 100th time that day, feeling frustrated and uncertain. At last, I simply gave up and devoured 100 pages of Lolita, sinking into its awful and hilarious reality so thoroughly that I forgot my own. In the morning, I realized I didn't have my Bob Marley t-shirt. I'd left it on that branch to dry the day before. Losing my boots was bad, but losing my Bob Marley t-shirt was worse. That shirt wasn't just any old shirt. It was, at least according to Paco, a sacred shirt that meant I walked with the spirits of the animals, earth, and sky. I didn't know if I believed that, but the shirt had become an emblem of something I couldn't quite name. I reinforced my duct tape booties with another layer of tape and walked all through the humid day. The night before, I'd made a plan. I would follow this road wherever it led me. I'd ignore all the others that crossed its path, no matter how intriguing or promising they looked. I'd finally become convinced that if I didn't, I'd only walk an endless maze. By late afternoon, I sensed that the road was leading me somewhere. It got wider and less rutted, and the forest opened up ahead. Finally, I rounded a bend and saw an unmanned tractor. Beyond the tractor, there was a paved, two-lane road. I crossed it, turned left, and walked along its shoulder. I was on Highway 89, I could only assume. I pulled out my maps and traced a route I could hitchhike back to the PCT, and then set to work trying to get a ride, feeling self-conscious in my metal-gray boots made of tape. Cars passed in clumps of two and three with long breaks in between. I stood on the highway for half an hour holding out my thumb, feeling a mounting anxiety. At last, a man driving a pickup truck pulled to the side. I went to the passenger door and opened it up. "You can throw your pack in the back," he said. He was a large bull of a man in his late 40s, I guessed. "Is this Highway 89?" I asked. He looked at me befuddled. "You don't even know what road you're on?" I shook my head. "What in the Lord's name have you got on your feet?" he asked. Nearly an hour later, he dropped me off at a place where the PCT crossed a gravel road in the forest, not unlike those I'd followed when lost the day before. The next day, I hiked at what for me was record speed, spurred on by my desire to reach Castle Crags by day's end. My guidebook explained that, as usual, I wouldn't exactly be arriving at a town. The trail emerged at a state park that bordered a convenience store and post office. But that was enough for me. The post office would have my boots and my resupply box. The convenience store had a small restaurant where I could fulfill at least some of my food and beverage fantasies once I retrieved the $20 bill from my box. And the state park offered a free campsite to PCT hikers, where I could also get a hot shower. By the time I dragged into Castle Crags at 3, I was almost barefoot, my booties disintegrating. I hobbled into the post office with strips of dirt-caked tape flapping along beside me and inquired about my mail. "There should be two boxes for me," I added, feeling desperate about the package from REI. As I waited for the clerk to return from the back room, it occurred to me that I might have something else besides the boots and my resupply box. Letters. I'd sent notifications to all the stops I'd missed when I'd bypassed, instructing that my mail be forwarded here. "Here you go," said the clerk, setting my resupply box heavily on the counter.
"But there should be... Is there something from REI? It would be..."
"One thing at a time," she called as she returned to the back room. By the time I walked out of the post office, I was almost whooping out loud with joy and relief, along with the pristine cardboard box that contained my boots. My boots! I held 9 letters addressed to me at stops along the way I hadn't gone, written in hands I recognized. I sat on the concrete near the little building, shuffling quickly through the envelopes, too overwhelmed to open any yet. One was from Paul, one was from Joe, another was from Karen. The rest were from friends scattered around the country. I set them aside and ripped the box from REI open with my knife. Inside, carefully wrapped in paper, were my brown leather boots. The same boots that had gone over the side of the mountain, only new and one size bigger. "Cheryl," a woman called, and I looked up. It was Sarah, one of the women from the two couples I'd met in Burney Falls, standing there without her pack. "What are you doing here?" she asked. "What are you doing here?" I replied. I expected her to still be behind me on the trail. "We got lost. We ended up coming out on the highway and hitching a ride."
"I got lost too," I said in delighted surprise, grateful that I wasn't the only one who'd managed to lose the trail.
"Everyone got lost," she said. "Come on." She gestured to the entrance of the restaurant at the end of the building. "We're all inside."
"I'll be right in," I said.
After she left, I took my new boots out of their box, peeled off my booties for the last time, and tossed them into a nearby garbage can. I opened my resupply box and found a fresh pair of clean, never-worn socks, put them on my filthy feet, and then laced my boots on. They were impeccably clean. They seemed almost a work of art in their perfection as I paced the parking lot. The wonder of their virgin tread, the glory of their unmarked toes. They felt stiff but roomy, like they would work, though I worried about the fact that I'd be breaking them in on the trail. There was nothing I could do but hope for the best. "Cheryl," Rex boomed when I walked into the restaurant. Stacy was sitting beside him, and beside her were Sam and Helen and John and Sarah, the six of them practically filling the small restaurant. "Welcome to paradise," said John, with a bottle of beer in hand. We ate cheeseburgers and fries, then afterwards walked through the convenience store in post-prandial ecstasy, loading our arms full of chips and cookies and beer and double-sized bottles of cheap red wine, pooling our money to pay for it all. The seven of us trooped giddily up a hill to the state park campground, where we crammed our tents close together in a circle in the designated free campsite and spent the evening around the picnic table, laughing and telling story after story as the light faded from the sky. While we talked, two black bears, who actually looked black, emerged from the trees that ringed our campsite, only mildly afraid of us when we shouted at them to go away. Throughout the evening, I repeatedly filled the little paper cup I'd taken from the convenience store, gulping smooth sips of wine as if it were water, until it tasted like nothing but water to me. It didn't feel like I'd hiked 17 miles in mid-90s heat that day with a pack on my back and duct tape wound around my feet. It seemed as if I'd floated there instead, like the picnic table was the best place I'd ever been or would ever be. I didn't realize that I was drunk until we all decided to turn in and I stood up, and it struck me that the art of standing had changed. In an instant, I was down on my hands and knees, retching miserably onto the dirt in the middle of our camp. In spite of all the ridiculousness of my life in the preceding years, I'd never been sick from alcohol before. When I was done, Stacy placed my water bottle beside me, murmuring that I needed to drink. The real me inside the blur I'd become realized she was right, that I wasn't only drunk but also profoundly dehydrated. I hadn't had a sip of water since I was on the hot trail that afternoon. I forced myself to sit up and drink. When I took a sip, I instantly retched again. In the morning, I rose before the others and did what I could to sweep the vomit away with the branch of a fir tree. I went to the shower room, took off my dirty clothes, and stood under the hot spray of water in the concrete stall, feeling like someone had beaten me the night before. I didn't have time to be hungover. I planned to be back on the trail by midday. I dressed and returned to camp and sat at the table, drinking as much water as I could tolerate, reading all nine of my letters one by one while the others slept. Paul was philosophical and loving about our divorce. Joe was romantic and rash, saying nothing about whether he was in rehab. Karen was brief and workaday, providing me with an update about her life. The letters from friends were a rush of love and gossip, news and funny tales. By the time I finished reading them, the others were emerging from their tents, limping into the day the way I did each morning until my joints warmed up. I was grateful that every last one of them looked at least half as hungover as me. We all smiled at one another, miserable and amused. Helen, Sam, and Sarah left to take showers, Rex and Stacy to pay one more visit to the store. "They have cinnamon rolls," said Rex, trying to tempt me to join them as they walked away, but I waved him off, not only because the idea of eating made my stomach roil. Between the burger and the wine and the snacks I'd purchased the afternoon before, I was already, and yet again, down to a little less than $5. When they left, I culled my resupply box, organizing my food into a pile to pack into Monster. I'd be carrying a heavy load of food on this next stretch, one of the longest sections on the PCT. It was 156 miles to Syed Valley.
You and Sarah need any dinners? I asked John, who was sitting at the table, the two of us briefly alone in camp. I got extras of these. I held up a packet of something called Fiesta noodles, a dish I'd tolerated well enough in the early days but now loathed. Nah, thanks, he said. I pulled out James Joyce's Dubliners and put it to my nose, the cover green and tattered. It smelled musty and nice, exactly like the used bookstore in Minneapolis where I'd purchased it months earlier. I opened it and saw my copy had been printed decades before I was born. What's this? John asked, reaching for a postcard I'd bought in the convenience store the afternoon before. It was a photograph of a chainsaw carving of a Sasquatch, the words Bigfoot Country emblazoned across the top of the card. Do you believe they exist? He asked, putting the card back. No, but the people who do claim that this is the Bigfoot capital of the world. People say a lot of things, he replied. Well, if they're anywhere, I suppose it would be here, I said, and we looked around. Beyond the trees that surrounded us stood the ancient gray rocks called Castle Crags, their crenellated summits rising cathedral-like above us. We'd passed them soon on the trail as we hiked through a miles-long band of granite and ultramafic rocks that my guidebook described as igneous in origin and intrusive by nature. Whatever that meant. I'd never been much interested in geology, but I didn't need to know the meaning of ultramafic to see that I was moving into different country. My transition into the Cascade Range had been like the one I'd experienced crossing into the Sierra Nevada. I'd been hiking for days in each before I felt I was actually entering my idea of them. Only one more stop, said John, as if he could read my thoughts. We've just got Syed Valley and then it's on to Oregon. We're only about 200 miles from the border. I nodded and smiled. I didn't think the words only and 200 miles belonged in the same sentence. I hadn't let myself think much beyond the next stop. Oregon, he exclaimed, and the joy in his voice almost lured me in, almost made it seem like those 200 miles would be a snap. But I knew better. There hadn't been a week on the trail that hadn't been a crucible for me. Oregon, I conceded, my face going serious. But California first. Chapter 14. Wild. Sometimes it seemed that the Pacific Crest Trail was one long mountain I was ascending, that at my journey's end at the Columbia River, I'd reached the trail's summit rather than its lowest point. This feeling of ascension wasn't only metaphorical. It literally felt as if I were almost always impossibly going up. At times I almost wept with the relentlessness of it, my muscles and lungs searing with the effort. It was only when I thought I couldn't go up any longer that the trail would level off and descend. How fabulous down was for those first minutes. Down, down, down I'd go, until down too became impossible and punishing and so relentless that I'd pray for the trail to go back up. Going down, I realized, was like taking hold of the loose strand of yarn on a sweater you'd just spent hours knitting and pulling it until the entire sweater unraveled into a pile of string. Hiking the PCT was the maddening effort of knitting that sweater and unraveling it over and over again, as if everything gained was inevitably lost. When I left Castle Crags at 2, an hour behind Stacy and Rex, and a few hours ahead of the couples, I was wearing boots that were a whole blissful size bigger than the last pair had been. I'm the Bigfoot, I joked as I said goodbye to the couples. I walked up and up into the searing hot day, feeling exuberant to be on the trail, the last dregs of my hangover soon sweated out of me. Up and up I went all through that afternoon and the following day, though it wasn't long before my enthusiasm over my new boots faded, replaced by the bleak understanding that footwise, things weren't going to be any different for me. My new boots had only chawed my feet afresh. I was passing through the beautiful territory I'd come to take for granted, my body finally up to the task of hiking the big miles, but because of my foot troubles, I sank into the grimmest despair. I remembered making that wish upon the star when I was with Brent in Beldentown. It appeared that I really had jinxed myself by saying it aloud. Perhaps my feet would never be okay. Lost in a spiral of bitter thoughts on my second day out of Castle Crags, I nearly stepped on two rattlesnakes that sat coiled up on the trail within a few miles of each other. Each snake had literally rattled me back from where I was, warning me off at the last minute. Chastened, I tried to rattle myself back, too. I marched on, imagining unimaginable things. That my feet were not actually attached to me, say, or that the sensation I was having wasn't really pain, but simply a sensation. Hot, angry, sick of myself, I stopped for lunch beneath the shade of a tree, laid out my tarp, and reclined on it. I'd camped with Rex and Stacy the night before, and planned to meet up with them again that night. The couples were still somewhere behind us, but I'd spent the day hiking alone without seeing a soul. I watched birds of prey soaring far over the rocky peaks, the occasional white, wispy cloud traveling slowly across the sky, until I fell asleep without meaning to. I woke up a half hour later with a startled gasp, creeped out by a dream, the same dream I'd had the night before. In it, Bigfoot had kidnapped me. He'd done it in a fairly mannerly fashion, approaching to pull me by the hand deep into the woods, where an entire village of other Bigfoots lived. In the dream, I was both astonished and frightened at the sight of them. "How have you hid from humans so long?" I'd asked my Bigfoot captor, but he only grunted. As I looked at him, I realized that he was not a Bigfoot at all, but a man wearing a mask and a hairy suit. I could see his pale human flesh beneath the edge of his mask, which terrified me. I brushed the dream aside when I'd awakened that morning, blaming it on the postcard I'd bought in Castle Crags. But now that I had the dream twice, it seemed to carry more weight, as if the dream weren't really a dream, but a foreboding sign. Of what, I didn't know. I stood up, hoisted Monster back on, and scanned the lined crags, the rocky peaks and high gray and rust-colored cliffs that surrounded me near and far among the patches of green trees, feeling a cool unease. When I met up with Stacy and Rex that evening, I was more than a little relieved to see them. I'd felt jumpy for hours, tentative about the small noises that came from the bushes and unnerved by the long silences. "How are your feet?" asked Stacy as I pitched my tent near hers. In reply, I only sat in the dirt and pulled my boots and socks off and showed them to her. "Damn," she whispered. "That looks painful." "So guess what I heard yesterday morning at the store?" asked Rex. He was stirring a pot of something over the flame of his stove, his face still pink from the day's exertions. "Apparently there's this thing called the Rainbow Gathering up ahead at Toad Lake." "Toad Lake?" I asked, suddenly remembering the woman I'd met in the restroom at the Reno bus station. She'd been going there. "Yeah," said Rex. "It's only half a mile off the trail, about 9 miles up ahead. I think we should go." I clapped my hands in glee. "What's the Rainbow Gathering?" asked Stacy. I explained it to them while we ate dinner. I'd gone a couple of summers before. The Rainbow Gathering is organized by the Rainbow Family of Living Light, a loose tribe of so-called free thinkers who share a common goal of peace and love on Earth. Every summer, they set up an encampment on national forest land that attracts thousands in a celebration that culminates during the 4th of July week, but simmers all summer long. "There are drum jams and bonfires and parties," I explained to Rex and Stacy. "But best of all, there are these amazing outdoor kitchens where people go and make all these breads and cook vegetables and stews and rice, all sorts of things that anyone can just go and eat." "Anyone?" asked Rex in a pained voice. "Yep," I said. "You just bring your own cup and spoon." While we talked, I decided that I'd stay at the Rainbow Gathering for a few days, my hiking schedule be damned. I needed to let my feet heal and to get my head back in the game, to shake this spooky feeling that had blossomed inside me, that I might be abducted by a mythical bipedal humanoid beast. And possibly, just perhaps, I might get myself laid by a hot hippie. Later in my tent, I rummaged through my pack and found the condom I'd carried all this way, the one I'd rescued back in Kennedy Meadows when Albert had purged the rest from my pack. It was still unspoiled in its little white packet. It seemed it was high time to put it to use. In the 6 weeks I'd been on the trail, I hadn't even masturbated, too wrecked by the end of each day to do anything but read, and too repulsed by my own sweaty stench for my mind to move in any direction but sleep. The next day, I walked faster than ever, wincing with each step, the trail undulating between 6,500 and 7,300 feet, as it offered up views of high, pristine lakes below the trail and endless mountains in the near and far distance. It was noon when we started down the little trail that descended from the PCT to Toad Lake.
"It doesn't look like much so far," said Rex as we gazed at the lake 350 feet below.
"It doesn't look like anything," I said. There was only the lake surrounded by a gathering of scraggly pines with Mount Shasta to the east. After having it in sight north of me since Hat Creek Rim, I was now finally moving past the showy 14,000-foot peak.
"Maybe the gathering is back a ways from the water," said Stacy,
though once we reached the lake shore, it was clear that there was no happy encampment, no writhing mass of people jamming and tripping and making hearty stew. There were no dark breads or sexy hippies. The rainbow gathering was a bust. The three of us lunched dejectedly near the lake, eating the miserable things we always ate. Afterwards, Rex went for a swim, and Stacy and I walked without our packs down the steep trail toward a jeep road our guidebook said was there. In spite of the evidence, we hadn't entirely given up hope that we'd find the rainbow gathering. But when we came to the rough dirt road after 10 minutes, there was nothing, no one. It was all trees, dirt, rocks, and weeds, just like it had always been.
"I guess we got the wrong information,"
said Stacy, scanning the landscape, her voice high with the same rage and regret that welled in me. My disappointment felt tremendous and infantile, like I might have the sort of tantrum I hadn't had since I was 3. I went to a large flat boulder next to the road, lay down on it, and closed my eyes to blot the stupid world out so this wouldn't be the thing that finally brought me to tears on the trail. The rock was warm and smooth, wide as a table. It felt incredibly good against my back.
"Wait," said Stacy after a while. "I thought I heard something."
I opened my eyes and listened.
"Probably just the wind," I said, hearing nothing. "Probably."
She looked at me, and we smiled wanly at each other. She wore a sun hat that tied under her chin, and short shorts with gaiters that went up to her knees, a get-up that always made her look like a Girl Scout to me. When I'd first met her, I'd been slightly disappointed that she wasn't more like my friends and me. She was quieter, emotionally cooler, less feminist and artsy and political, more mainstream. If we'd met off the trail, I didn't know if we'd have become friends, but by now she'd become dear to me.
"I hear it again," she said suddenly, looking down the road.
I stood up when a small beat-up pickup truck packed full of people rounded the bend. It had Oregon plates. It drove straight up to us and screeched to a sudden stop a few feet away. Before the driver had even turned the engine off, the 7 people and 2 dogs in the truck started leaping out. Ragtag and grubby, dressed in high hippie regalia, these people were unquestionably members of the Rainbow Tribe. Even the dogs were discreetly funked out in bandanas and beads. I reached to touch their furry backs as they darted past me and into the weeds.
"Hi,"
Stacy and I said in unison to the 4 men and 3 women who stood before us, though in return, they only gazed at us, squinty-eyed and aggrieved, as if they'd emerged from a cave rather than the bed or the cab of a truck. It seemed as if they'd been up all night or were coming down from hallucinogenics, or both.
"Is this the Rainbow Gathering?"
the man who'd been behind the wheel demanded. He was tan and small-boned. A strange, grungy white headband that covered most of his head held his long, wavy hair back from his face.
"That's what we were looking for, too, but we're the only ones here," I replied.
"Oh, my fucking God,"
moaned a pale waif of a woman with a bare skeletal midriff and a collage of Celtic tattoos.
We drove all the way from fucking Ashland for nothing?
She went to lie across the boulder I'd recently vacated.
I'm so hungry, I'm seriously gonna die.
I'm hungry too,
whined another of the women, a black-haired dwarf who wore a string belt with little silver bells attached to it. She went and stood by the waif and petted her head.
Fucking focalizers,
bellowed the headband man.
Fucking right,
mumbled a man with a green mohawk and a big silver nose ring, like the kind you see every now and then on a bull.
You know what I'm gonna do? Asked the headband man. I'm gonna make my own fucking gathering up at Crater Lake. I don't need those fucking focalizers to tell me where to go. I got major influence around here.
How far is Crater Lake?
Asked the last of the women in an Australian accent. She was tall, beautiful, and blonde. Everything about her a spectacle. Her hair in a heap of dreadlocks bundled on top of her head, her ears pierced with what looked like actual bird bones, her every last finger clad in extravagant rings.
Not too far, Toots, said the headband man.
Don't call me Toots, she replied.
Is Toots offensive in Australia? He asked.
She sighed, then made a growling sound.
All right, baby, I won't call you Toots then,
he cackled to the sky.
But I will call you baby if it damn well please. Like Jimi Hendrix said, I call everybody baby.
My eyes met Stacy's. We were trying to find the gathering too, I said. We heard it was here.
We're hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, added Stacy.
I need food, wailed the waif on the rock.
I've got some you're welcome to, I said to her, but it's up at the lake. She only looked at me, her face expressionless, her eyes glazed. I wondered how old she was. She seemed to be my age, and yet she could have passed for 12.
Do you have room in your car? Asked the Australian confidentially. If you two are headed back to Ashland, I'd catch a ride with you.
We're on foot, I said to her blank stare. We have backpacks. We left them up at the lake.
Actually, we are going to Ashland, said Stacy, but it'll take us about 12 days to get there.
The two of us left, though no one else did. They all piled back into the truck and drove away a few minutes later, and Stacy and I walked the trail back to Toad Lake. The two couples were sitting with Rex when we returned, and we all hiked back up to the PCT together, though it wasn't long before I was bringing up the rear, the last limp into camp that night near dark, hindered by the catastrophe of my feet.
We didn't think you were going to make it, said Sarah. We thought you'd already stopped to camp.
Well, I'm here, I replied, feeling stung, though I knew she meant only to console me about my foot troubles. In the midst of our drinking and storytelling back in Castle Crags, Sam had joked that my trail name should be The Hapless Hiker, after I'd told them about my various misadventures. I'd laughed at the time. The Hapless Hiker seemed a fairly apt name. But I didn't want to be that hiker. I wanted to be the hard-ass motherfucking Amazonian queen. In the morning, I rose before the others, quietly mixing my better-than-milk into my pot with cold water and mildly stale granola and raisins. I'd woken from another Bigfoot dream, almost exactly the same as the two previous ones. As I ate my breakfast, I found myself listening carefully for sounds in the still dark trees. I hiked away before the others even emerged from their tents, happy to get a head start. Exhausted, slow, and footsore as I was, hapless as I might be, I was keeping up with the others, the people I thought of as real hikers. 17 and 19 miles a day, day after day, had become de rigueur. An hour out, I heard an enormous crashing in the bushes and trees beside me. I froze, unsure of whether to yell or remain perfectly quiet. I couldn't help it. Silly as it was, that man with the Bigfoot mask in my dreams flashed through my mind. Ah! I yelled when a hairy beast materialized in front of me on the trail, so close I could smell him. A bear, I realized a moment later. His eyes passed blandly over me before he snorted and reeled and ran northward up the trail. Why did they always have to run in the direction I was going? I waited a few minutes and then hiked on, picking my way trepidatiously along, belting out lines from songs.
Oh, I could drink a case of you, darling, and I would still be on my feet, I crooned loudly. She was a fast machine, she kept her motor clean, I growled. Time out for tiny little tea leaves in Tetley tea, I chirped. It worked. I didn't run into the bear again, or Bigfoot. Instead, I came upon something I actually had to fear. A wide sheaf of icy snow covering the trail at a 40-degree angle. Hot as it was, not all the snow had melted off the north-facing slopes. I could see to the other side of the snow. I could practically throw a stone across it. But I couldn't do the same with myself. I had to walk it. I looked down the mountain, my eyes following the course of the snow, should I slip and slide. It ended far below, at a gathering of jagged boulders. Beyond them, there was only air. I began to chip my way across, kicking each step with my boots, bracing myself with my ski pole. Instead of feeling more confident on the snow, given the experience I'd had with it in the Sierra, I felt more shaken, more aware of what could go wrong. One foot slipped out from beneath me and I fell onto my hands. Slowly, I stood again, with my knees bent. I'm going to fall, was the thought that came into my head, and with it I froze and looked down at the boulders below me, imagining myself careening into them. I looked at the place I'd come from and the place I was going, the two equidistant from me. I was too far from either, so I forced my way forward. I went down on my hands and crawled the rest of the way across, my legs shaking uncontrollably, my ski pole clanging along beside me, dangling from my wrist by its pink nylon strap. When I reached the trail on the other side, I felt stupid and weak and sorry for myself, vulnerable in a way I hadn't felt on the trail before, envious of the couples who had each other, and of Rex and Stacy, who had so easily become a hiking pair. When Rex left the trail in Syed Valley, Stacy would be meeting her friend Dee so they could hike through Oregon together. But I'd forever be alone. And why? What did being alone do? I'm not afraid, I said, calling up my old mantra to calm my mind. But it didn't feel the same as it usually did to say it. Perhaps because that wasn't entirely true anymore. Perhaps by now I'd come far enough that I had the guts to be afraid. When I stopped for lunch, I lingered until the others caught up to me. They told me they'd met a backcountry ranger who warned them of a forest fire to the west and north near Happy Valley. It hadn't affected the PCT so far, but he told them to be on alert. I let them all hike ahead, saying I'd catch up to them by nightfall, and walked alone into the heat of the afternoon. A couple of hours later, I came to a spring in an idyllic meadow and stopped to get water. It was too beautiful a spot to leave, so afterwards I lingered, soaking my feet in the spring until I heard an ever-loudening jangle of bells. I had only just scrambled to my feet when a white llama rounded the bend and came bounding straight up to me with a toothy grin on his face. Ah! I yelled, the same as I had when I saw the bear, but I reached for the lead rope that dangled from his halter anyway, an old habit from my childhood with horses. The llama wore a pack that was strung with silver bells, not so unlike the belt on the woman I'd met at Toad Lake. Easy, I said to him as I stood, barefoot and stunned, wondering what to do next. He looked stunned too, his expression both comical and stern. It occurred to me that he might bite me, but I had no way to know. I'd never been so close to a llama. I'd never even been far from a llama. I'd had so little experience with llamas that I wasn't even 100% sure that a llama was what he was. He smelled like burlap and morning breath. I pulled him discreetly in the direction of my boots and stuffed my feet into them, and then petted his long, bristly neck in a vigorous manner that I hoped struck him as commanding. After a few minutes, an old woman with two gray braids down the sides of her head came along. You got him, thank you, she called, smiling broadly, her eyes twinkling. With the exception of the small pack on her back,
She looked like a woman out of a fairy tale. Elfin, plump, and rosy-cheeked. A small boy walked behind her, and a big brown dog followed him.
I let go for a moment, and off he went, the woman said, laughing and taking the llama's rope from me. I figured you'd catch him. We met your friends up the way, and they said you'd be coming along. I'm Vera, and this is my friend Kyle, she said, pointing to the boy. He's 5.
Hello, I said, gazing down at him. I'm Cheryl. He had an empty glass maple syrup bottle full of water slung over his shoulder on a thick string, which was odd to see, glass on the trail, and it was also odd to see him. It had been ages since I'd been in the company of a child.
Hello, he replied, his seawater gray eyes darting up to meet mine.
And you've already met Shooting Star, said Vera, patting the llama's neck.
You forgot Miriam,
Kyle said to Vera. He placed his small hand on the dog's head.
This is Miriam.
Hello, Miriam, I said.
Are you having a good time hiking? I asked Kyle.
We're having a wonderful time,
he answered in a strangely formal tone, then went to splash his hands in the spring. I chatted with Vera while Kyle tossed blades of grass into the water and watched them float away. She told me she lived in a little town in central Oregon and backpacked as often as she could. Kyle and his mother had been in a horrible situation, she said in a low voice, living on the streets of Portland. Vera had met them only a few months before through something they were all involved in called Basic Life Principles. Kyle's mother had asked Vera to take Kyle on this hike while she got her life straightened out.
You promised not to tell people about my problems, Kyle yelled vehemently, charging over to us. I'm not telling about your problems, Vera said amiably, though it wasn't true. Because I've got big problems and I don't want to tell people I don't know about them, Kyle said, his eyes going to mine again. A lot of people have big problems, I said. I've had big problems.
What kinds of problems? He asked.
Like problems with my dad, I said uncertainly, wishing I hadn't said it.
I hadn't spent enough time with children to be exactly sure how honest one should be with a 5-year-old.
I didn't really have a dad, I explained in a mildly cheerful tone.
I don't have a dad either, Kyle said. Well, everybody has a dad, but I don't know mine anymore. I used to know him when I was a baby, but I don't remember it.
He opened his palms and looked down at them. They were full of tiny blades of grass. We watched as they fluttered away in the wind.
What about your mommy?
He asked.
She's dead.
His face shot up to mine, his expression moving from startled to serene.
My mommy likes to sing, he said. You want to hear a song she taught me?
Yes, I said.
And without a moment's hesitation, he sang every last lyric and verse of Red River Valley in a voice so pure that I felt gutted.
Thank you, I said,
half demolished by the time he finished.
That might be the best thing I've ever heard in my whole life. My mother has taught me many songs, he said solemnly. She's a singer.
Vera snapped a photograph of me, and I cinched Monster back on.
Goodbye, Kyle. Goodbye, Vera. Goodbye, Shooting Star,
I called as I walked up the trail.
Cheryl,
Kyle hollered when I was nearly out of sight. I stopped and turned.
The dog's name is Miriam. Adios, Miriam, I said.
Late in the afternoon, I came to a shady spot where there was a picnic table, a rare luxury on the trail. As I approached, I saw that there was a peach on top of the table and beneath it a note. Cheryl, we yogied this from day hikers for you. Enjoy, Sam and Helen. I was thrilled about the peach, of course. Fresh fruit and vegetables competed with Snapple lemonade in my food fantasy mind. But more so, I was touched that Sam and Helen had left it for me. They, no doubt, had food fantasies every bit as all-consuming as my own. I sat on top of the picnic table and bit blissfully into the peach, its exquisite juice seeming to reach my every cell. The peach made it not so bad that my feet were a throbbing mass of pulp. The kindness with which it was given blunted the heat and tedium of the day. As I sat eating it, I realized I wasn't going to be able to thank Sam and Helen for leaving it for me. I was ready to be alone again. I was going to camp by myself that night. When I tossed the peach pit, I saw that I was surrounded by hundreds of azaleas in a dozen shades of pink and pale orange, a few of their petals blowing off in the breeze. They seemed to be a gift to me, like the peach and Kyle singing Red River Valley. As difficult and maddening as the trail could be, there was hardly a day that passed that didn't offer up some form of what was called trail magic in the PCT vernacular. The unexpected and sweet happenings that stand out in stark relief to the challenges of the trail. Before I stood to put Monster on, I heard footsteps and turned. There was a deer walking toward me on the trail, seemingly unaware of my presence. I made a small sound so as not to startle her, but instead of bolting away, she only stopped and looked at me, sniffing in my direction before slowly continuing toward me. With each step, she paused to assess whether she should continue forward, and each time she did, coming closer and closer until she was only 10 feet away. Her face was calm and curious, her nose extending as far as it dared in my direction. I sat still, watching her, not feeling even a little bit afraid, as I'd been weeks before when the fox had stood to study me in the snow. "It's okay," I whispered to the deer, not knowing what I was going to say until I said it. "You're safe in this world." When I spoke, it was as if a spell had been broken. The deer lost all interest in me, though she still didn't run. She only lifted her head and stepped away, picking through the azaleas with her delicate hooves, nibbling on plants as she went. I hiked alone the next few days, up and down and up again, over Etna Summit and into the Marble Mountains on the long, hot slog to Syed Valley, past lakes where I was compelled by mosquitoes to slather myself in DEET for the first time on my trip, and into the paths of day hikers who gave me reports about the wildfires that were raging in the west, though still not encroaching on the PCT. One night I made camp in a grassy spot from which I could see the evidence of those fires, a hazy scrim of smoke blanketing the westward view. I sat in my chair for an hour, looking out across the land as the sun faded into the smoke. I'd seen a lot of breathtaking sunsets in my evenings on the PCT, but this one was more spectacular than any in a while. The light made indistinct, melting into 1,000 shades of yellow, pink, orange, and purple over the waves of green land. I could have been reading Dubliners, or falling off to sleep in the cocoon of my sleeping bag, but on this night the sky was too mesmerizing to leave. As I watched it, I realized I'd passed the midpoint of my hike. I'd been out on the trail for 50-some days. If all went as planned in another 50 days, I'd be done with the PCT. Whatever was going to happen to me out here would have happened. Oh, remember the Red River Valley and the cowboy who loved you so true, I sang, my voice trailing off, not knowing the rest of the words. Images of Kyle's little face and hands came to me, reverberations of his flawless voice. I wondered if I would ever be a mother, and what kind of horrible situation Kyle's mother was in, where his father might be, and where mine was. What is he doing right this minute, I'd thought occasionally throughout my life, but I was never able to imagine it. I didn't know my own father's life. He was there, but invisible. A shadow beast in the woods. A fire so far away it's nothing but smoke. That was my father. The man who hadn't fathered me. It amazed me every time, again and again and again. Of all the wild things, his failure to love me the way he should have had always been the wildest thing of all. But on that night, as I gazed out over the darkening land, 50-some nights out on the PCT, it occurred to me that I didn't have to be amazed by him anymore. There were so many other amazing things in this world. They opened up inside of me like a river, like I didn't know I could take a breath, and then I breathed. I laughed with the joy of it. And the next moment,
I was crying my first tears on the PCT. I cried and I cried and I cried. I wasn't crying because I was happy. I wasn't crying because I was sad. I wasn't crying because of my mother or my father or Paul. I was crying because I was full of those 50-some hard days on the trail and of the 9,760 days that had come before them, too. I was entering. I was leaving. California streamed behind me like a long silk veil. I didn't feel like a big fat idiot anymore. And I didn't feel like a hard-ass motherfucking Amazonian queen. I felt fierce and humble and gathered up inside, like I was safe in this world, too. Part 5. Box of Rain. I'm a slow walker, but I never walk back. Abraham Lincoln. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Mary Oliver, The Summer Day. Chapter 15. Box of Rain. I woke in the darkness on my second-to-last night in California to the sound of wind whipping the branches of the trees and the tap-tapping of rain against my tent. It had been so dry all summer long that I'd stopped putting the rain cover on, sleeping with only a wide pane of mesh between the sky and me. I scrambled barefoot into the dark to pull my rain cover over my tent, shivering, though it was early August. It had been in the 90s for weeks, sometimes even reaching 100, but with the wind and the rain, the weather had suddenly shifted. Back in my tent, I put on my fleeced leggings and anorak, crawled into my sleeping bag and zipped it all the way up to my chin, cinching its hood tight around my head. When I woke at 6, the little thermometer on my backpack said that it was 37 degrees. I hiked along a high ridgeline in the rain, dressed in most of what I had. Each time I stopped for more than a few minutes, I grew so chilled that my teeth chattered comically until I walked on and began to sweat again. On clear days, my guidebook claimed, Oregon was in view to the north, but I couldn't see anything for the thick fog that obscured anything beyond 10 feet. I didn't need to see Oregon. I could feel it, huge before me. I would walk its entire length if I made it all the way to the Bridge of the Gods. Who would I be if I did? Who would I be if I didn't? Mid-morning, Stacy appeared out of the mist, walking southbound on the trail. We'd hiked away from Syed Valley together the day before after spending a night with Rex and the couples. In the morning, Rex had caught a bus back to his real life, while the rest of us walked on, splitting up a few hours out. I was fairly certain I wouldn't see the couples on the trail again, but Stacy and I had made plans to meet up in Ashland, where she was going to lay over for a few days, waiting for her friend Dee to arrive before they began their hike through Oregon. Seeing her now startled me, as if she were part woman, part ghost. I'm heading back to Syed Valley, she said, and explained that she was cold, her feet were blistered, and her down sleeping bag had gotten drenched the night before, and she had no hope of drying it out before nightfall. I'm taking a bus to Ashland, she said. Come find me at the hostel when you get there. I hugged her before she walked away, the fog enveloping her again in seconds. The next morning, I woke earlier than normal, the sky the palest gray. It had stopped raining, and the air had warmed up. I felt excited as I strapped on Monster and walked away from my camp. These were my last miles in California. I was less than a mile away from the border when a branch that hung along the edge of the trail caught on my William J. Crockett bracelet and sent it flying off into the dense brush. I scanned the rocks and bushes and trees, panicky, knowing as I pushed into the weeds that it was a lost cause. I wouldn't find the bracelet. I hadn't seen where it had gone. It had only made the faintest ping as it flew away from me. It seemed absurd that I'd lose the bracelet at this very moment, a clear omen of trouble ahead. I tried to twist it around in my mind and make the loss represent something good, a symbol of things I didn't need anymore, perhaps, of lightening the figurative load.
But then the idea flattened out, and I thought only of William J. Crockett himself, the man from Minnesota who'd been about my age when he died in Vietnam, whose remains had never been found, whose family no doubt still grieved him. My bracelet wasn't anything but a symbol of the life he lost too young. The universe had simply taken it into its hungry, ruthless maw. There was nothing to do but go on. I reached the border only minutes later, stopping to take it in. California and Oregon, an end and a beginning pressed up against each other. For such a momentous spot, it didn't look all that momentous. There was only a brown metal box that held a trail register and a sign that said, Washington, 498 miles. No mention of Oregon itself. But I knew what those 498 miles were. I'd been in California 2 months, but it seemed like I'd aged years since I'd stood on Tehachapi Pass, alone with my pack, and imagined reaching this spot. I went to the metal box, pulled out the trail register, and paged through it, reading the entries from the previous weeks. There were notes from a few people whose names I'd never seen, and others from people I hadn't met but whom I felt I knew because I'd been trailing them all summer. The most recent entries were from the couples, John and Sarah, Helen and Sam. Beneath their jubilant entries, I wrote my own, so overwhelmed with emotion that I opted to be concise. I made it. Oregon. 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 I was here. I walked into it, catching views of the peaks of majestic Mount Shasta to the south, and the lower but sterner Mount McLaughlin to the north. I hiked high on a ridgeline, coming to short, icy patches of snow that I crossed with the help of my ski pole. I could see cows grazing in the high green meadows not far below me, their big square bells clanking as they moved. "Hello, Oregon cows," I called to them. That night I camped under a nearly full moon, the sky bright and cool. I opened J.M. Coetzee's Waiting for the Barbarians, but read only a few pages because I couldn't concentrate. My mind wandered to thoughts of Ashland instead. It was finally so close that I could bear to let myself think about it. In Ashland, there would be food, music, and wine, and people who knew nothing of the PCT. And most important, there'd be money, and not just my usual $20. I'd put $250 in traveler's checks into my Ashland box, originally believing that it would be the box that greeted me at the very end of my trip. It didn't contain food or resupplies. It had only traveler's checks and a real-world outfit to wear. My favorite faded blue Levi's and a slim-fitting black t-shirt. A brand-new black lace bra and matching underwear. It was in these things that months before I thought I'd celebrate the end of my trip and catch a ride back to Portland. When I'd changed my itinerary, I'd asked Lisa to put that small box into another of the boxes I'd loaded down with food and supplies and readdress it to Ashland instead of one of the stops I wasn't going to make in the Sierra Nevada. I couldn't wait to get my hands on it, that box within the box, and spend the weekend wearing non-trail clothes. I arrived in Ashland the next day around lunchtime after hitching a ride from the trail with a group of AmeriCorps volunteers. "Did you hear the big news?" one of them had asked after I'd climbed into their van. I shook my head without explaining that I'd heard little news, big or small, for 2 months. "You know the Grateful Dead?" he asked, and I nodded. "Jerry Garcia is dead." I stood on a sidewalk in the center of town and bent to see an image of Garcia's face in psychedelic colors on the front page of the local paper, reading what I could through the newspaper box's clear plastic window, too broke to spring for a copy. I'd liked several of the Grateful Dead songs, but I'd never collected tapes of their live shows or followed them around the country like some of my Deadhead friends had. Kurt Cobain's death the year before had felt closer to me, his sad and violent end a cautionary tale not only of my generation's excesses, but of my own as well. And yet, Garcia's death felt bigger, as if it was the end of not just a moment, but an era that had lasted all of my life. I walked with Monster on my back a few blocks to the post office passing homemade signs propped in store windows that said, "We love you, Jerry, R.I.P." The streets were alive with a mix of